can't come true.
Welcome to A New Way to Handle Absolutely Everything with your host, Elise Coit.
And welcome everyone to A New Way to Handle Absolutely Everything. Today, I am so honored to host an hour with Swami Kriyananda, a well-known direct disciple of Paramhansa Yogananda. And if you were one of the people touched by Autobiography of a Yogi, you will know something about, a little bit about, where we're headed today. It's funny, this week, as I read Swami Kriyananda's book, The New Path, My Life with Paramhansa Yogananda, so many people said to me, oh my goodness, that book, Autobiography of a Yogi, that changed my life. And I'm just thrilled that we are going to continue that conversation here today. Today's show will be about a spiritual journey. We said we'd talk about the inward path. And this is a journey I invite you to take with us today, but also into yourself, to take a moment to settle in and think for yourself what that means to you. And I was thinking as I read the book, A New Path, this week, that I have had in my life so many questions about my own desire and my calling to understand my spiritual identity since I was a child. And there was really something in this book so stirring for me, very powerful and yet very intimate, about the nature of that inquiry that is, I believe, in all of us, this call to look within. And as I've been engaged this week in listening more to that call and feeling very, very moved by it and having my own inquiry, I thought we'll bring this today to you. And as you listen, I think what you'll take away is some counsel, some comfort, and a sense of, I hope, at least it's my intention, a sense of the closeness of the divine in you. A New Path, the Swami Kriyananda's book, is an inspirational account of what it's like to really answer that call that I'm talking about. Answer the yearning for a spiritually based life by really leaving everything and walking a path of dedication, and what it's like to then grow spiritually under the wing of, in this case, Paramahansa Yogananda as a monk, and also Swami Kriyananda's continued dedication to Yogananda's work in the world. So with me today, Swami Kriyananda, who's a teacher of meditation and yoga, as I said, continuing Yogananda's work for thousands of people around the world. And for the last 60 years, he's been helping others to awaken to their sense of divine truth. And this book, The New Path, My Life with Paramahansa Yogananda, is only one of his many books and also music that I've come to discover this week. And you'll find him if you go to swamikriyananda.org. If that's long and difficult for reading over the radio, don't worry. You can always go to my site and find it, swamikriyananda.org. And you can also find more videos and his recent talks in Los Angeles available on ananda.org. That's ananda.org. And again, you'll find that all linked to on my site, as well as the link to information about his book and also Autobiography of a Yogi. So I want to welcome Swamiji to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
And thank you for inviting me.
It's lovely. This account of your being so close to one of the most loved spiritual masters and teachers, and who many consider a saint, was just so moving. You know, your own guru, Paramahansa Yogananda. What did you hope to offer with the... This is a new edition of a book you've written before, I know, as well.
Yes, so. It's more complete and better edited, and basically that's the difference. There are a few new stories, but basically it's the same one I wrote many years ago. It's just much better.
And that's worth doing, isn't it? that's wonderful. And what do you hope as people read this new version of the book? And there are a couple new stories, but we find information new to us anytime we come to it anyway, right? I know I saw Autobiography of a Yogi years ago and never picked it up. So, you know, everything is new to us in some way. When you think of the readers who read your book, what would you like to offer them?
Well, you know, I guess in a way, although I'm different, each one of us is different, but in a way I'm very typical of the modern seeker, because tried to do it without God. I tried through physics, through astronomy, through politics, through the arts, through every means I could possibly find, thinking to find, because I didn't find inspiration in the churches, and I just didn't like that kind of God. I didn't like the thought that somebody's up there checking me off and sort of ticking off my mistakes and deciding whether I should go to hell or not. It just didn't make any sense. Anyway, I did my best, but I found that every single path by which I thought, it ended up with the conclusion that without God, nothing makes sense. So I remember one night, I went out into the countryside around Charleston, which is where I was living at the time. I'm not from there. But I was thinking, if there's a God, what must he be? Well, he can't be a judge. He's got to be bigger than that. And finally, I came to the conclusion that what's making me ask this question is that I'm conscious. He, therefore, must be consciousness. And then that means the closer I am to him, the more open I am to him, the more inspiration I will feel in my life, and the more joy I will feel in my life. And I had come to equate truth not with some mental abstraction, but with joy. And I realized that the only real purpose in life is to be more in tune with him. And that same evening, I decided in that case, I'm going to dedicate my life to seeking God. Then came the big problem. First of all, I hadn't ever read about saints. I didn't know they existed. I thought, maybe I'm going crazy. I mean, how do you seek God? I was just very puzzled about this. In fact, I remember going upstate New York and thinking, maybe I'm just too jaded. I need to get out in the simple country. And I realized that I couldn't enjoy the country, the beauty of a sunlight on a dewdrop, because there was something missing in me. I was like a motor working on one cylinder. And I just realized I just had to try to meditate. And I didn't know what meditation was. But it's just then that I found Autobiography of a Yogi. I didn't know anything about the Indian teachings, but that book so moved me that I took the next bus from New York to Los Angeles, where he was living, and the first words I said to him were, "I want to be your disciple." And I have never reneged on that. That's been my constant purpose and driving force all my life. That was 62 years ago, in 1948. And now I'm a young man of 84, and I still have that same deep desire. And the other desire that I've had is that this is so wonderful. I want everybody in the world to know about it. And so my greatest motivation in writing all these books and writing all this music and starting all these communities and everything has been to spread this idea, because this, only this, can give people what they want. And what I can say in a different way is this, because there was an atheist in Australia who said, "Well, how can you define God in such a way as to impress me?" And I said, "Oh, why don't you think of God as the highest potential you can imagine for yourself? Coming closer to God does not mean coming closer to somebody sitting on a mountaintop. It means coming closer to who you are, getting to know yourself on deeper and deeper levels. If you can go beneath all your superficial desires, you will find that the basic thing you want is to know who you are, where you fit in things, and how defined in everything you do an unshakable bliss.
I spent the week with your book and with that question that you were talking about, you know, this question that we have and that I felt in my life, you know, what is this discomfort I feel about who I am and who how do I fit in and what is God? And
there's something in all of us that makes us feel there has to be happiness somewhere. And people keep thinking to find that happiness outward in things. They'll never find them that way. You get tired of things. You can listen to the most beautiful music in the world, and sooner or later you'll get tired of it. You just have to turn it off and have silence. The only thing finally, and if it's a very interesting thing, if you study humanity, you'll find the only people who are consistently happy are the saints. That must mean something. A saint isn't somebody who helps little old ladies across the street. A saint is somebody who knows himself and is so unshakable in his bliss. I remember a story of Teresa Neumann. She was a great Catholic stigmatist in the last century. And when she was a young maiden, some of the various swains would come a-courting, and she would have nothing to do with them. Sometimes she went so far as to drive them off the farm with a pitchfork. And somebody might say, well, is this his Christian humility? I would answer, no, it's not Christian humility. It's Christian bliss. She was absolutely, she knew what she wanted. And I love that story.
I love that. And I love the distinction that you've started us with. About,
you know, Elise, I'd be very grateful if you'd talk a little bit more loudly.
Oh, I'd be happy to. How's that?
Thank you. That's better.
This the bliss, the joy, my own path, as you talk about that, my own path, I really recognize the intellectual part of it because it doesn't feel like bliss and joy. And I really got that this week reading your book. If people feel like me, what would you offer them? You know, okay, let's say I understand a lot of my searching is intellectual. A lot of my experience might be intellectual. How do I turn more towards the joy?
You know, there is a great Christian missionary called Frank Laumbach, and he wrote a little booklet about conversations with God. I forget the actual name. Letters from a Modern Mystic. And he made it a point. He'd been a minister for many years and hadn't received the satisfaction he wanted. And so he undertook this simple experiment to share every moment of his life with God. To talk to God as if he were in the second person. Say you, not he or she. And he found that after a very short time, he began to feel this bliss in everything. I got to meet him, and it was really a great inspiration. It was just a few months before he died. But he was a great man and a great example. Whatever your religion, it doesn't matter what you believe. People used to believe the world is flat. That didn't make it so. But he wanted to have the experience. And that experience you can have even if you believe in a sacred crocodile. If you think of God as anything you want, but talk to him, you'll find that he comes to you as bliss.
Well, I love the idea that you offered that God is the highest potential in us. I often think of the ego as the conglomeration of the smallest ideas I have about myself. So that really hit me. Yeah. Well, since as we're talking about these,
you know, you have to talk a little more loudly.
Okay, I'll do that. And my producer can take care if I'm shouting too much. So you went about this search with a guru and found Paramahansa Yogananda and joined his community.
I read that book in New York. As I said, I took the next bus across the country. But most of this book is then given to my life with him. And I think it's a very important book because it makes it seem as if the reader were there with me. I've tried to include the reader and make him feel that he was on the scene, not that I was so fortunate as to have this experience, but that you're having it with me. And it was really a fantastic experience to be with this man who was in God all the time. I'm so grateful for that time.
You talked about that time in the most interesting way. I mean, attunement is the word that comes to mind, and I just loved that. And I'll tell you why. I think now, as opposed to the 60s, we've kind of the whole idea of studying with a guru or a master has come out of favor a little bit. And I love the way you redefined this, the whole relationship as attunement with the guru. Can you explain that? Because I just think that added so much to my understanding of what working with someone him was like.
You know, something very interesting in the Bible, in the Gospel of St. John, right at the beginning, it said, as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God. Now, receiving him doesn't mean signing on the dotted line that you believe. It means that you receive him in attunement with him. You feel his consciousness, and you feel him guiding you. This is a true guru. I know that some people, they come to me sort of belligerently saying, do I need a guru? I say, of course you don't need a guru. Just go following your own ego. But if you need God, if you need God, you'll know that you need help. And if you want help, a guru can give it to you far better than the head of General Motors. So think about that.
Well, we have lots of gurus, and they're the things that we buy and accumulate.
Exactly.
And look to,
you need
really
teachers
wish.
In everything you do. And it's not that you have to follow anybody slavishly, but it does mean that we're a social animal and we can benefit from one another's company. But a guru, in the highest sense, is one who has experienced God and can help you to share that experience with him.
Hmm. Do people ever ask you to help them determine whether someone is the right guru for them or if they're a sound person? I mean, I see a lot of
they
people asking
They do sometimes,
those questions.
But mm-hmm. basically what I say is that you have to feel it in yourself. One of the beautiful things they say in India is that when you are ready, the guru appears. That means you don't have to walk the counter and check every item on that counter to see which one to buy. When you seek God seriously, he will send you the person who can help you. And in the beginning, he sends you books. Then he sends you teachers. And the deeper you go, the more you find that you are led to the one person who you know can help you. In my case, it was very interesting because my dad was a geologist for Exxon. It was called Esso in those days. And I know that if he had been in the country, it would have been very difficult for me. But he was sent to Cairo in Egypt. And the day that I put my mother on the ship to go join him was the day that I found Autobiography of a Yogi. They weren't there to try to stop me. And for me, too, it would have been quite difficult to leave a completely known life to a completely unknown life. But they weren't there. And so I was footloose and fancy free, you could say. And that's how I was able to take that bus across the country. So God helps out. When you want him, people think of God as some sort of abstract force. But in fact, he's there helping you. And he's conscious of your thoughts. He is you. You are his manifestation. And the more you seek him seriously, the more he listens and takes you seriously.
I always wondered about this idea that if God is us, why do we have a path? Why do we have a journey to find that thing that is us?
Well, isn't that an oddity?
Yeah.
That's really one of the beautiful contradictions of the spiritual path. It's full of contradictions that finally resolve themselves, but this is certainly one of them. You take a pilgrimage, and suddenly you find that you've only gone seeking your own self. There's a story of the musk deer in India, where at a certain season in the year, the musk deer secretes in a pouch in its navel the odor of musk. And he goes crazy sometimes looking, trying to find where the source of this fragrance is. And sometimes it'll jump off a high crag and crash to its death, and the hunter will come and take that pouch and sell it in the marketplace. And a poet writing about that said, "Oh, musk deer, if you had only understood that the fragrance that you were seeking had its source in your own self." So pilgrimages are good, everything is good, but finally the pilgrimage of life is to find yourself and the truth within yourself.
And you took a very radical decision. I say radical, but I mean it just because it's a decision many people will not take.
Louder?
You made a decision that many people will never make, to give up everything and to dedicate your entire life to this purpose.
Well, I don't know if you'd call me a fanatic. I'm sure some people would.
I don't know if it's fanatic.
I absolutely wanted truth. I remember in college, my roommate said to me, "Why are you thinking all the time?" But I couldn't help it. I just needed to know, what is life all about? Why are we here? What's the purpose of our existence? And if I'd gone by love, I could have found it quickly. But I went by the intellect. But fortunately, I was very truthful with myself. And so my search through the intellect was not through books, but through thinking. And my thinking led me to this conclusion, finally, that God has to be consciousness. Therefore, I need to increase my attunement with his consciousness. And once I found that, there was nothing. I was born in Romania, but in this country, I lived in Scarsdale, New York, which is sort of the epitome of suburbia. And all my companions, friends, we're getting married, we're getting good jobs, we're buying homes in Scarsdale or other towns around there. But I just looked at it and I thought, that's not for me. I just don't want it. What do I want? This is partly why I wondered if I was going crazy, because I really wanted it intensely. And yet, I didn't know that anybody had ever found such things.
Well, we'll take a break, but I want, when we come back from the break, to talk a little more about that and how that ties in with the communities you've created. You know, this balance between seeking a spiritual life and doing what you did, which was to give up everything and pursue that life, and people who feel that they can't do that, still feeling that there's an option.
I never felt I was giving anything up.
Right. That's wonderful. Thank you for catching that. That is true. Okay. On that note, we'll take a break. We'll come back in a few minutes, and we'll talk a little bit more about the communities that you founded.
Yeah,
and
gladly.
The work going out into the world. I'd really enjoy talking about the work that you're doing today and how people can find out more about that, too. We'll be right back after a quick break with Swami Kriyananda, the author of The New Path, My Life with Paramhansa Yogananda. And you're listening to A New Way to Handle Absolutely Everything with Elise Coit. I'll see you in just a moment. And And welcome back to the show, whether you're listening live now, and thank you for being here, or you're listening on the podcast on iTunes or however you listen, whether you're on the site, which is elisecoit.com. Thank you so much. I'm enjoying very much talking today with Swami Kriyananda about his life and his book, The New Path, My Life with Paramhansa Yogananda. And we are going to continue now for the second part of the show and talk a little bit more together. Welcome back, Swamiji. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Asking me about different news here in Los Angeles tomorrow, I mentioned that I've written a lot of music. I've written over 400 pieces of music. And I wrote an oratorio after a visit to Israel. And that's going to be performed by our Ananda Choir tomorrow, Saturday, at 7 p.m., it's at Forest Lawn at the Church of the Recessional. Forest Lawn Cemetery, the Church of the Recessional. And then Sunday, the next day, at 11 a.m., I will be giving a talk there, and you're welcome to come there. It's open to people of all faiths, of course. And finally, in January and February, I'll be giving 6 weeks of a series of 6 weeks of classes called 6 Weeks to Lasting Success and Happiness. So I hope people can come to that. And another thing I'd like to say is that I invite you to download a free gift, an excerpt from my book, Living Wisely, Living Well, Timeless Wisdom to Enrich Every Day, at ananda.org. So that's my little announcement.
No, that's wonderful. And so let me give the dates. So that would be in Los Angeles tomorrow the 4th, for those who catch this on the podcast, and Sunday the 5th. And the Los Angeles lectures, you're giving a few more of those on the Sunday as well, up until Christmas.
Well, I tell you, this Sunday will be the last for a month.
That's the last one. Okay.
I'm going to Hawaii for a little rest.
Okay. And then the course that you're doing, Living Wisely.
The course is Lessons, Lasting Success and Happiness, How to Achieve Them.
And would you be doing that online or over the phone, or is that at the community?
It will be not over the phone. It will be, however, available in person and online.
Okay.
At ananda.la.org.
AnandaLA.org.
Yeah, okay, LA for Los Angeles.
Okay. And I'll be sure and put that on my site as well. So if you go to my site, if you've missed that, then all the information will be there. AnandaLA.org. So that's AnandaLA.org for all that information, including the free gift. Thank you very much. I'm going to go get that as well. Look forward to it. You know, it has meant a lot to me to read your book this week. I just want to thank you personally for that, too. It's been the most important question in my life. We were talking before the break how it led you to Paramhansa Yogananda, to his teachings, and to being a disciple. And it raised a question in me about those of us who won't be a disciple in the way you were. In other words, we won't necessarily go to a community. We have families. We're married. I'd like to talk about the communities you've created where people come together in spiritual fellowship and what those are all about. Because, you know, I wouldn't want people to think, well, you've got to, you know, got to leave everything, leave your husband, go to an ashram, wear a robe, and that's the only way to get, you know, to get your spiritual life started.
No, why do you have to leave your husband?
Of course not.
Why do you have to leave anything, really? You may have to go from one home to another, but you still have a body. You still have a need to live in something. So it isn't much that you're giving up. What you're giving up is restlessness and maybe a boss who is too bossy and going to live with a very harmonious group of people who are supportive to you, instead of always snapping at you for something you did wrong. We have a group of very harmonious people at Ananda. And we now have about, in all our 8 communities, I would estimate, about 1,000 members. We have schools for children in health, education for life system. We have jobs. We don't allow certain things. We don't allow drugs or alcohol. We don't force people to be vegetarian. We just say that it's more healthful. But I imagine everybody in our communities is vegetarian. We don't snoop and see what they're really doing. We take it for granted that they have come there. They have come to improve, and therefore we expect them to improve and sincerely as well as they can. So these communities, which I started over 40 years ago, the first one, they have proved themselves, and we can say that it does work. That's the wonderful thing.
So, you know, there's so much people talk. You know, a lot of the communities in the 60s broke down and went away. So
ours is probably the only successful one. But I had been thinking about it since the age of 15. You know, all of us are born for some reason. I think maybe I was born to start these communities because at the age of 15 already, I was very seriously wanting to start communities, and I got all my friends enthusiastic until they found I was serious and I was left alone. But I still studied it. I went around the world looking at different groups, the kibbutz in Israel and different groups, just to see how it would work. So by the time I started it, I knew what some of the pitfalls were. And anyway, it has worked.
What do you think is the biggest thing people come to the community for when they arrive? Is it to escape the world?
I think you want peace of mind and happiness and the feeling that they're directing their lives consciously rather than just being pebbles bobbed down the stream by the water. And everybody who comes is looking for a way of life that will give him more happiness.
And I appreciate the work that you do in the world outside the communities as well for those, you know, through your books. And I want to mention to people, too, that if you go to ananda.org, there are a lot of videos of your talks. You know, you can watch the talks from Los Angeles right there on the website. And
we have a community in Seattle, by the way.
Okay. And we're broadcasting live in Seattle, so that's wonderful. How many communities around the world now?
8. We have several, and we have one in Seattle, Portland, Palo Alto, Sacramento, Nevada City. These are in California. Then we have one in near Assisi in Italy. We have one in Gurgaon in near Delhi, and one in near Pune. These two in India. So 8 in all.
Is there something particular about the Ananda communities that make them work? I mean, I understand the mission and why people come. What's the secret, do you think, of why they're successful?
I think I have to say partly it's the leadership. I don't bully anybody. I'm supportive of them, but I'm firm in having my ideals, and I think that's part of it. I think the fact that everybody there, and I have to say that this does, I think every community always reflects the spirit of the leader, but I hope it'll go on after I die, that this feeling of sharing with people, of wanting to help one another, to support one another. When a couple get married, then everybody pitches in to help them with the honeymoon or help them get settled. If somebody's in the hospital, you not only have blood relatives, you've got friends coming to see you and take care of you. It's wonderful to have a sense of family with many people rather than with two or three who often squabble among each other, among themselves.
And we're, you know, we were talking over the break that, you know, we're headed to hard times.
Yes, we are.
A lot of us.
This will be very important because, honestly, Yogananda predicted this idea of communities would spread like wildfire. I think people will see, and the sooner they see, the easier it'll be, that if you can get land, do it with other people, because very few people can live alone. I mean, I would be hopeless as a carpenter or a farmer, but we've got people at Ananda who, any need there is, somebody knows how to do it. And we can find that we can grow our own food, build our own buildings, and live self-sufficiently without worrying about an economy that is going galley west.
I
think that we're coming to a time of very serious depression, and I think these communities are perhaps the greatest thing I can offer to the world, an example of how a group of people can live together, and people who follow our particular system as we've evolved it, they will find it easy. Otherwise, when you don't have a system, then it's very difficult to know how to do it.
Could you take that system you've developed and use it in your family or in a country or government? I mean, it sounds like you've discovered principles for living in peace that we all need to know.
I hope that it will be so. I can't change circumstances. They have to just sort of adjust themselves. But I hope, not by driving or forcing, but by offering an example that works, that people will take from this and take it seriously and follow it. For example, I wrote a book on the art of supportive leadership, and many big businesses have taken this as a manual. And just recently we got a phone call from the U.S. Army asking for permission to use this book in their officers' training corps, which is about the last group of people you'd expect to want it. But I was very pleased that they want to use this book, because it talks to leadership that doesn't boss, but helps people, that guides them, and makes them want to do what you're trying to do instead of forcing it down their throats.
What's a core principle that you've found of harmony and peace that we could take into, say, family? I mean, where we're going to Christmas, and a lot of people during Christmas really suffer from their family dynamic. I had someone telling me just a couple of weeks ago how awful Thanksgiving was, you know, and how contentious and difficult, you know, we families can be. How can someone bring some peace of mind for themselves into their own families?
It's so natural. It's a little hard to put myself in that position. We had one Thanksgiving here in Los Angeles, and we had about 50 people come, and it was a very harmonious meeting. I think, however, certain thoughts come to my mind. When people talk, listen to them. Don't just spout your own opinion. React to them. Answer their questions. Don't just spout your own opinions. Respect other people. Don't just think that, why are you this way and why are you that way? Respect them for who they are. Everybody's different. So kindness is very important. Listening is very important. Respect is very important. These three principles, if you would apply them to anybody, your neighbors, anybody, you'll find that your life can change completely. I remember I was in Taormina in Sicily, Italy, some years ago, and it was a very hot day, and I thought of buying a hat. And so I asked the proprietress of this hat store, which hat do your customers like? And I asked her partly because this is my way of making friends with people, asking for help and trying to involve them in things, but it didn't work at all with her. And she said, what do I care? They take their choice, they pay me their money, and they leave, and that's as far as I care. And I was just so shocked at this answer that I found myself answering, quite strongly. I said, you're just wasting your life. I said, here you are, 8 hours a day, let's say, in your shop, just thinking in terms of the money you're going to gather in from people. You have an opportunity to make friends. You have an opportunity to learn something about life from them. And you think of nothing but your own money. And I was a little firm with her. And I thought, well, I'll never see her again. Well, the next year, I was going down the street, and Taormin is a small town, and I happened to pass her, and she was in the street, and I just gave her a nod of recognition, and she came over with tears in her eyes and kissed me on the cheeks before I could get my guard up, and she said, you've changed my life. And the hotel gave me a bottle of wine for being a repeat customer, and I don't drink wine, so I took that bottle to her, and she was really weeping. So you can change people's lives if you show an interest in them. Here in Los Angeles, it's hard to make eye contact with people, but I try, as Yogananda said, when you see a dour face, shoot it with a buckshot of your smiles. And I try to do that when I see strangers. And I find it works. One time I was in Paris, and it happened to be my birthday, and I wanted to go to a concert, and the doors were closing, and they were turning people away. There were about 50 people outside who couldn't get in. And I cried out in French, which I happen to speak, that, but it's my birthday. And the man said, oh, well, happy birthday. Please come in. So he put me, audience area was completely filled, 700 people. So he had to put me behind the altar. But I enjoyed the music thoroughly. And I suppose my enjoyment showed, because a little later I was on the metro, and this old lady well into her 70s, she came over to me and said, do you remember me? And I said, well, I'm sorry, I don't. But I was in the audience of the concert tonight. Well, 700 people, my goodness. But she had felt such a connection with me because of the way I was enjoying the music that she felt we were friends. She sat down and was talking to me about problems she was having with her daughter and so on. But you'll find that you can make friends easily and everywhere if you show an interest first in them. Most people wait to see, well, how will people react to me. Just put your hand out first. Just give your smile first. And you will see that people will answer you accordingly. And their lives will be changed.
And yours too. I mean, what I heard listening to you was how my life would change if I did that. My experience of people would change. And that is worth doing. And in all of this, of course, underneath all of it has been where we started, which is our search for a relationship with our own sense of the divine, our sense of ourselves, our spiritual life.
Yeah.
And that feeds everything you're talking about, I know.
And, you know, I had a dream a few months ago. This was in Florence, Italy. And I saw many, many people, thousands of people. But I saw that there was one thing, although they were all on very different states of consciousness. Some of them were criminals, some businessmen, just all types. And I saw that there was one thing that tied them all together. Everybody is seeking happiness. Very few people find it because they define happiness in the wrong terms. But everybody is seeking it. And I saw that in this one fact, everybody is my brother and sister. You belong to everybody and everybody belongs to you. It's a wonderful feeling because you can go through the streets of a city and feel that all these people are your own.
Well, no wonder you called it the Ananda World Brotherhood Village.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I wanted to talk about one thing that people, if they know Paramahansa Yogananda's work, will know about, and that is Kriya Yoga. And just a little bit, maybe you could mention the role of Kriya Yoga in spiritual life.
Kriya Yoga says that everything, all our reactions to the world, depend upon, it's our reactions, not the world, that makes the thing look beautiful or sad. And our reactions all basically come back to two currents in the spine. This is the fascinating thing about yoga, that it ties in with known realities. But as this energy rises in the ira, as they call it, in the spine, let's just say, then you feel good about things. And when the energy goes down, you feel badly about these things. Now, we need to neutralize our reactive process so that we can take anything that happens and it doesn't affect us personally. We can create our own happiness. Well, Kriya Yoga takes it right to the source, to your own spine. Everything depends upon the energies going up and down your own spine. This is so esoteric that I couldn't begin to clarify it here just quickly on the air like this. But it does come back to you, and Kriya Yoga helps you to understand how it comes back to you and how you can bring that equilibrium where nothing will affect you badly and everything can be turned as you choose it to the reaction you want. For example, once when I was a child, I was beaten up by a bully who was much bigger than I. And I beat him by this simple fact that I just didn't let it bother me. I've treated him the same way afterwards. He didn't know how to handle that. And so I can say I beat him. He never touched me again. He gave me a wide berth. And so, although he beat me to a pulp, I didn't let it bother me. I know people in the dormitory were saying, well, why didn't you shout out? We'd have helped you. I said, I wasn't afraid. So that's what I'm talking about. Not reacting. Being impartial in life. You will see that if you can learn to do that, you can absolutely control your own existence. And whatever happens, you can turn it to the good.
And a lot of what I talk about on this show has to do with that, understanding our choices, our reactions.
Yes, I know, and I was very pleased
that
I saw that on your bio or whatever it is.
Well, there's a lot for those listening to look on the site. And actually, Asha Praver was on the show earlier this year talking about times of crisis.
And
so
she's a member of ours.
She is. So for those listening, if you'd like to go to the site, you can always hear that archive show with Asha and learn more. I knew we weren't going to get a chance to talk about Kriya, but I did want to mention it for people who, you know, to know about. It's the body and mind and spirit all working together.
And they're interconnected. Yes, indeed.
And there is information on ananda.org about Kriya, about some of the techniques, and also I believe you can there's an online course you can sign up for to learn more about it if that's of interest to listeners. Well, we're going to run out of time.
Well, I'm sorry, because this has been fun.
It has been. Is there anything, you know, that you'd like to leave with listeners, something we could do after the show that would begin to change life for us? Most people listen because they're seeking change.
When you go down the street and you see a stranger, well, if you're a woman, you can't look at a man without seeming to invite him. But apart from those simple facts of life, I know that, for example, when I see somebody who's wearing nice colors, I thank that person for the colors. I thank him for giving me pleasure. Look upon people as your own friends. And I don't want to say brothers and sisters, because brothers and sisters often fight. They're friends. And you will see that in some way you'll always have a friend wherever you go.
It's so funny you should say that. Someone said to me recently, if I just treated my spouse as well as I treat my friends, my whole relationship would probably transform.
Yeah.
The way we talk to each other, we just wouldn't talk to a friend like that. In fact, I think the story was that they'd made an agreement to talk to one another as if they were best friends.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Let me let people know again how to find your book and information about your work and the Ananda communities. So the book is The New Path, My Life with Paramhansa Yogananda, written by Swami Kriyananda, my guest today. And you can find out more about him and his work at two places, swamikriyananda.org and ananda.org. And all that information is up on the site. So if you're,
and then
if you're listening,
Ananda LA to find what I'm doing in Los Angeles.
That's right. Ananda LA for the lectures this weekend, the 4th and 5th, the last lecture of the series on Sunday. But the videos are there of the previous ones. And the gift you so kindly offered, Living Wisely, Living Well, you'll find on Ananda LA as well. Is that right?
So thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. It has been such a pleasure. I'm going to close by saying that, you know, in a couple of weeks, my father is here, and we're going to, he's written a book about his spiritual search. In fact, you might be interested. About 40 years ago, he just decided he was going to spend a year just listening to God's direction and everything.
I'd love to get that book myself.
Well, I will send you a copy if you like.
Thank you kindly.
It's coming out, and he'll be on the show in a few weeks for those who'd like to join me on December 17th. And next week, I am with Roy Holman to talk about service to self and service to the earth, how those connect, how our work in service to others and to the earth helps our growth, and how our growth helps the earth and others as well. So that will take us into Christmas. And again, I just want to thank you very much, Swamiji, for being here.
It's been my joy.
And thank you for the work you do.
Thank you,
too. Everyone listening, you can find all of this, plus all the show archives on elisecoit.com, as well as the latest things that I'm writing. I want you to know as well that I've put up an awful lot of new material in the free section. There are a few chapters of Steve Chandler's new book called Time Warrior, and you're welcome to go and read those. And there are also the links to the online versions of Autobiography of a Yogi, as well as the online version of The New Path, My Life with Paramhansa Yoga.
Autobiography of a Yogi, the first edition, is really the one to read.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much, and thank you for being here, everyone. I love you. I'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.